Hi, my name is Emily. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is December 8th, 2004. And my home group is the Midtown Group in Bethesda, Maryland. And I have a sponsor, and I'm available to sponsor others. I'm really nervous. I haven't spoken for an hour in a long time. But anyway, I'm going to just tell my story in a general way, what it was like, what happened, and then what it's like now. And I'll try not to tell my drinking story for too long. But I grew up in northern New Jersey, right outside of New York City. And as far as I remember, my childhood was just normal and fine. I had a little bit of a kind of dark negative side, and I just like to describe that with one story that I share sometimes at meetings. My best friend and I, we had this journal that we would write in and give it back and forth to each other, and in this journal we wrote what we'd want to be when we grow up, kind of like our fantasies, like played out, and her dream was that she was a celebrity and had a lot of celebrity friends and, went on, like, these grand vacations. And what I would write about was that I was finally dating the guy of my dreams from middle school, and we were real serious, and he was an alcoholic, and he would beat me, and I was anorexic, and I was in and out of the hospital, and, like, that to me was, like, what I wanted. And I don't know why, but that just, like, it filled me up, like, that's what I wanted so bad, that drama, that kind of dark side. I just, I didn't think there was anything wrong with it, but, but I just remember that when I was a couple years sober, like, that's probably not most middle school year olds, dream life. But it was mine, those after school TV specials just really got to me, and I don't know. But I didn't, that was even way before my drinking. I kind of drank, I think, kind of late. I started drinking when I was about 17 years old. And I remember exactly what it did for me. And I felt like, I was at my house. I was having a party because my mom was out of town, and of course that guy was invited. Years later, way into high school, he was still the guy I was in love with, though I'd never talked or spoken with him. And I had all my, my marching band friends there, and then I also had like all the popular kids there that I never could speak with because my mind, high school was like, this ladder, and I was way at the bottom. And I invited all the popular kids that I was so nervous about around. And when I, the beer finally got there, and I had just a couple. I hated the taste of it, but I remember that. I remember feeling like I could talk with anybody at that party. I mean, anybody, and it just didn't matter who it was. And not only that, but I felt like they wanted to talk to me too, and when we were all great friends then, and that guy that I was in love with, we talked and we spoke for the first time, and I just had a great time. I mean, it was like everything. It was like everything, it just made me so happy. It just filled me up inside. And I didn't drink from there regularly, probably not even every weekend. But I did know that something was there that I really wanted to go at, that I really wanted. And I think one thing that happened right after that was I got a boyfriend down here, not down here, in Annapolis, Maryland. And my dad lives in Annapolis, and my mom lives in New Jersey. They're divorced. And I convinced my mom that I needed to move down here to be with my dad, to be closer. And I think I probably had some other excuse. I can't remember what it was. But really, it was for this boyfriend. So I totally manipulated. I'm my mom's oldest daughter. I kind of really broke her heart. It was really hard for her to let go of me and to finish out high school down here. But she let me do it. And when I moved down here, like I had told my mom, I wanted to be closer with my dad. I didn't spend any time with my dad. I was always out with my boyfriend. He was kind of a, not a heavy drinker, but a social, you know, high school senior drinker. And he introduced me to this whole crowd of people who drank more like the way I wanted to drink, you know, more regularly. Every weekend there was a party going on. And I, either I was grounded, my mom's, you were talking about the chicken ring for the cell phone. My dad's, when he called me, it said, don't pick up on my cell phone so that I would know. Because if I was a little drunk, I might just pick up for anybody. But if it said, don't pick up, and I was a little drunk, I would know, okay, don't pick that up. That's got to be Dad asking where I was, or, you know, telling me I got to be home or whatever. And I didn't really want I thought, you know, I didn't want to hang out with my parents. I wanted to hang out and get drunk with my friends, because to me, it just made me feel so much better. And my dad, you know, my parents throughout the next couple of years would have these frequent talks with me about, you know, where my life is going, what do I want to do, and why can't you do this, and why can't you do that, and you've got to, you know, do these things if you want to get into college, and if you want to, you know, get on the right path. And I just thought, like, if you would just leave me alone and just let me have fun, that's what I'm supposed to do now, everything would be okay, you know, I'll get through life just fine. You know, they always used to say, it's all about Emily, it's all about Emily. And until I got sober, I just thought they were full of it. You know, I just thought, like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm just having fun. Leave me alone. When I got sober and they were saying, like, we are selfish and self-centered, I thought, whoa, they were really right. My parents really thought that too. I must be. But really, you know, anything that my parents asked of me was just like, it was just awful. I just didn't want to do anything that they asked of me. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. My dad, around that time, got really sick and was in the hospital for like a month or something. He had a heart aneurysm. And I remember that time feeling, I was really sad. I was really upset. But I was really sad and upset because, what is this going to do to me? You know, like, how am I affected by this? Oh, my God, this is so traumatic for me. My dad finally came home and, you know, I was asked, well, I guess it was expected that I help take care of him. And I thought that was such a lame thing to do. I just really, I couldn't believe that I was stuck at home helping my dad, who was attached permanently to this IV pole, you know. And I just couldn't believe how badly this affected my life. And I really caused a lot of damage there, you know, before that too, but especially during that time. And I just couldn't wait to go to college and get it done with it, you know. And then I wouldn't be asked to do these things like take care of my dad and empty the dishwasher, you know. Just I couldn't be bothered. And then so I finally did go to college. And I went to the University of Maryland, and I went there because it's a big party school, and it is, I found out. I just let loose there. I had the time of my life in college. It felt like as soon as I, especially the more drinking I did, that my world just grew so quickly, so big, so fast. I felt like the peak of my drinking was probably my second year of college. I was having the time of my life. I had a few consequences pretty quickly. I was in the hospital for a alcohol poisoning probably that first year, and I remember, I don't remember going to the hospital. It was alcohol poisoning, but I remember waking up the next morning thinking it was a bad dream. You know, maybe it was a brownout night, and I had glimpses of it, and I thought, oh, that was a bad dream. And then I saw the hospital bracelet on my wrist, and I thought, oh, my God, you know, how am I going to explain this to my parents? My dad just happens to be an alcoholic, and I had gotten these warnings throughout my life, oh, be careful of your drinking, you know, it runs in the family and all this. And you know, I was forced to call mom and dad and ask them to, you know, help bail me out of it. I was underage and there were some consequences, financially especially. And we got kicked out of that hotel room. And And then I remember, you know, one of my friends in particular, who was that girl I wrote the journals with. We had been friends since elementary school. And she was there that night. And the next morning, she was, I think, angry at me for getting us kicked out of the hotel room. And I just remember thinking, how dare you? You're mad at me? I just went to the hospital last night. Like, have some sympathy, please. Like, I am feeling like crap, you know? And she didn't have any sympathy. And we got kicked out of the hotel room, and I never spoke to her until about, I was 1 or 2 years sober. I didn't speak to her because I thought, you know, she didn't care about me, and she should have had more sympathy. But, so that was the first kind of big consequence I had. And funny enough, that's where my drinking lands me, is in the hospital. I was in and out of hospitals throughout my drinking. Never went to jail, you know, never divorced, obviously, never lost children or anything like that, but hospitals were my thing. I always blamed it on, you know, before I thought I was an alcoholic, I just blamed it on that my friends are too nice. My friends are too cautious. If they would just leave me alone, I'd probably be able to sleep it off and it'd be fine. But as I drank more and more, that's definitely not true. I seriously, you know, came close to death a couple of times. And I just, you know, basically my drinking was just, what happened to me when I drank was that even if it wasn't a big night, a big event, if it was just a Tuesday, in fact, my last big hospital visit drunk was a Tuesday. I would take a drink, and then I just couldn't stop. I just couldn't put it down. I don't know what it was. It was like Emily left the body and something else took over, and it just went to it. And because I really consciously rarely made the decision to get as drunk as I would. It was like I wanted to just get that buzz, you know, and the buzz was what I lived for, that good feeling like we're all friends and everything is great. And every single time I would overshoot the mark. And not every single time, but enough times it would cause a lot of problems and a lot of damage, too. And so you know, I couldn't figure out why these hospital visits and these bad things and the damage I caused people was happening to me. I guess I thought that for some reason bad stuff just happens to me. Yeah, it doesn't happen to my friends, but I just have bad luck. I guess is probably what I thought. I don't know. But when that happens enough to an alcoholic, I feel like I'm blessed that I finally had some kind of moment of grace that happened to me. And it was after this, particularly the last hospital visit, I pray. I remember waking up in the hospital that night. I came to in the hospital bed, and the doctors, they were shaking padded handcuffs over my hands, telling me if I didn't stop being so violent, they would have to handcuff me to the bed. And I'm not a violent person. I had just come out of a blackout. I had no idea where I was. And I just passed out again. And then I woke up and still in the hospital that morning. They told me what blood alcohol level was, and they, you know, were telling me that they tried to pump my stomach, but I was being so violent, and they couldn't, so I'm going to have to stay in there a little longer. And I remember shaking so badly, and I remember the nurses were being so nice to me. And I just felt disgusted with myself because I didn't deserve to be treated so nicely. But they were being so kind. And I just thought, if you only knew, like, this happens to me all the time. I can't believe I'm here again, you know. And I just really felt disgusted with myself. And I was just, I couldn't believe it just kept happening to me and not my friends. And that was the moment of grace where I realized this is not happening to my friends. Why is this happening to me? I really don't know how to stop this because I feel like I try to control my drinking. You know, I tried different ways to you know, count the number of drinks I take or just have beer or not have tequila, anything but tequila. Tequila was my drink choice. Or, you know, I just tried all these different little things. I thought, if I just do this, it'll be okay. And it was never okay. It never got better. It just kept getting worse and worse. And I just knew I couldn't stop drinking on my own. I just knew it. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I thought someday I'll be able to control it, but I don't know how to start that process of learning how to control and enjoy my drinking. So I had a little bit of surrender right there. I agreed, you know, before I called my parents, I figured I'll tell them I'm going to get some help because that's what they're going to tell me if they don't send me to rehab. So I decided to go get some help. And little did I know that whatever happened the night before put me in academic probation at school. So what, they were going to force me to get help anyway. So I just made it my decision, and it sounded better that way. But I was really in trouble. But I still don't know what it was for. So I went to the substance abuse counselor at school, and she was suggested that, you know, she had this list of questions, yes or no questions. Have you, you know, I'm sure we've all seen them, like, have you ever, you know, missed work because of school? Has your drinking caused any fights with your family, or has it caused you to lose friends, or all these things? And mine were yes, 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 no, yes, 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 yes. And I was honest with her for whatever reason. And she said, okay, well, maybe you could try to stop drinking for 3 months and keep coming to me, and we'll talk about what's going on in your head. And I thought, 3 months is a lifetime. I cannot stop drinking for 3 months. And I said, I don't think that's necessary. And she was like, well, you know, if you don't think you can do it, you could try Alcoholics Anonymous. I know of a great people. There's meetings with people. I know of a great meeting, people your age. And I was like, whoa, you know, I just need to come. If I could just learn how to control my drinking, then that would be fine. You know, and that's all I need to do. I don't need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And but she had, you know, the academic probation thing on her side, so she was like, well, if you don't, then there might be some. I was like, okay, fine, I'll just go. So she told me about this meeting to go to, which is now my home group. It was Midtown. It was my first meeting. At that time, it was down in D.C. There was probably 300 people there. I was not happy to be there. I had brought a friend. I remember, you know, she went with me, and she wore this bright yellow T-shirt that said, "Sunshine makes me happy," and I just wanted to punch her. I just felt like, I don't want to be here. Let's not talk to anybody. We'll go in, we'll go out, done. And if you've ever been to Midtown, that's not possible at Midtown, especially if you're looking as unhappy as I was. I was surrounded by women. The instant before I even got through the door, I was surrounded by women. They wanted to know how much time I had, and I was like, "Time what?" You know. And they gave me their phone numbers, asked me what I was doing. I really had no interest in hanging out with these people. They were way too happy, way too shiny, and I just felt like, I'm just trying to get sober for 3 months. I'm supposed to go to your meetings. That's all I need. And I really wasn't interested in anything related, anything Alcoholics Anonymous, any steps. I didn't even know about the steps. I remember totally judging the woman. There's two speakers that night. They both sounded I just didn't relate at all, you know. They were, like, over in Japan and, like, you know, lost all his, you know, everything. I don't even know what, but I didn't relate to him. And then there was this guy sitting next to me who was talking about how, you know, last week he drank and woke up in New Mexico, and I just was like, what is going on here? And I didn't want to be there, but at all. And the people would call me from AA, and I didn't respond to their calls. I don't think I really got a sponsor. I might have gotten one so that when people asked me if I had a sponsor, I just said yes, so they would stop asking me if I had a sponsor. But I didn't talk to her. But I did keep coming to meetings, because I had to. But after a certain point, I kind of liked I don't know if I liked coming, but I really did relate on some level. I don't know what, but I just, I felt so miserable. You know, I just felt so miserable, and I didn't know, I didn't know it was alcoholism, but, and I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. But I did keep coming around, and I don't even remember what my sixth meeting was. It lost count. I just kept coming. People were so friendly and inviting me back. But I did drink again. I got my 3 month chip, and then I was like, "See ya!" And I was quickly that night back to drinking, because I just really wanted to get out of trouble. So, I mean, I drank for I think 2 weeks, and I guess you would call it a relapse. It was more like I planned on it the whole time. But when I drank for those 2 weeks, there was no hospital visit or no hospitals. My hospital bills had long been paid off, and there was really no consequences. I just drank by myself because I was so miserable. But the thing that really helped me to hit my bottom wasn't the consequences. It was all in my head. It was that alcoholic committee that just chatters on and on and on. And for me, going to AA for 3 months and then drinking again, I don't want to say that it ruined my drinking, but it really put a damper on it. You know, it was really hard to just get wasted and not have that thought, like, are you an alcoholic? Look what you're doing. Oh, my God, you're an alcoholic. You're too young. Those people don't know what they're talking about. They don't know your real situation. You know your situation. You're fine. You've got years before you get to that level where your dad's at, you know. And God, that drove me crazy. It just really drove me crazy. And I would drink to drown it out, and then I would black out, and that was all I did. That was the cycle. And, I couldn't walk. I remember just walking to classes, just with me. Just me was just so loud. I wanted to scream at everybody and pull my hair out, and like, I just wanted so bad to just hurt something, you know, just punch something. I was just so lonely and so miserable, and my head would not be quiet. And I remember talking to this woman from Alcoholics Anonymous who called me. Just to see how I was doing and to check up on me, because she hadn't seen me in meetings for a while. And she, I remember the way that I thought of her was that she was a real alcoholic. She got sober when she was like 13 or 14, but she was in rehabs for years, and she was, I mean, a really low-bottom drunk in my mind. And when she told me her story, I related to it. You know, it was so strange that I related to someone who I thought was such a low-bottom drunk. But the way that she drank, it had nothing to do with her circumstances, but the way that she drank, I could not deny that I related to her. And the way that her life was then, I wanted so bad. You know, I really wanted to be happy and to feel useful and to have a life like she had. It's just to think of me, because she hasn't seen me in 2 weeks, I just couldn't even believe that. You know, I just was like, I can't think of anything but myself right now. I'm so crazy. And she totally related to me. And that phone call, I think, saved my life, you know. And she got me to come back to meetings. And I started coming back, and it was right before New Year's, and I remember, you know, that New Year thinking, my New Year's resolution is to try and stick with Alcoholics Anonymous and really give it my all, because I feel like I can't get any lower than I was now. And I did really, that's my sobriety date. That's the last time that I had to take a drink was right before that woman called me. And I did. Finally, I got a sponsor, and or that sponsor that was by name before became my real sponsor, and I really started working the steps with her. And I'll say this, the first step, I don't know that I got it right away. The first step says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I think I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. But the part that my life was unmanageable was really hard for me to grasp. I really thought, I think, like, if I just learn to control my drinking, it'll be okay. I think I had that reservation for a little while into sobriety. I want to say even probably for my first 18 months, I really felt that. When I started in AA, I remember being on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so miserable. They seemed to have a solution here. I went for it. things got kind of good, and then as I rested on my laurels, you know, for the next, like, year, I really started feeling that craziness again, like that alcoholic debate. And it never really left me for the first 18 months. I always had that in the back of my mind. When speakers would come up to the podium and say, I know that I'm alcoholic to the core of my being, I would say, not me. You know, I just knew it. And the more that I thought that, the less I would take the actions here, the actions that my sponsor would suggest of me. You know, the daily inventory, the helping others, you know, the just, I would pray. But as far as other things, I just don't think I was interested because I'm not drinking, so things should be okay, because I didn't think I was unmanageable. But the more that happened, the more that debate, you know, that kind of like black and white thinking, like, the more that came up. And I finally realized I had been missing a first step for the longest time. I mean, every morning I would wake up and think, you know, today's the day I'll take action. Today's the day I'll turn it all around. And then at night I would think, all right, well, tomorrow will be the day I'll turn it all around. You know, tomorrow I'll take that inventory. Tomorrow I'll call that new girl. Tomorrow I'll do that. And that's, you know, that just made me almost just as miserable as right before I got in here. That just not taking any actions in Alcoholics Anonymous and being surrounded by people who were in action and who really had a message made me miserable enough that I really started getting interested in the actions here. And I think I really started getting closer with the sponsor after that, and started being interested in especially doing my 8th and 9th step. I had done a 4th and 5th step, and then just stopped, like, okay, done, you know. 6 and 7 seem like one of those, like, daily things, so I'll just, you know, not worry about it until maybe my sponsor brings it up. But I did, I'll talk a little bit about my 4th and 5th step. The 4th step reads, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And then the 5th step reads, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. So I had to make that inventory. I'll tell you, when I think I had maybe 5 or 6 months, four months when I did my inventory, and I didn't get it. I thought it was a grudge list. And when my sponsor asked me to write my part, I saw the best that I could probably see at the time, and you know, a lot of the things that when I read it out to my sponsor, and you know, she would kind of tell me a similar story, it really did help me, and I really did learn that I am just a very petty and judgmental person. And the thing I remember most from doing that 5th step with her is that she said, you know, because I judged everybody, and I really related out a lot, and I mean, the first number one on my resentment list was like a fraternity, and then number two was like a political party. I mean, it was like I was just so judgmental of everything. And she said, you know, the next person that walks into Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't know what their background is, what their political party is, or what they did in college or whatever, but you might be the person that can help them. And if you're judging them, then how are you going to help them? You know, and you might be the one person that could say something that could be really helpful. And that made sense to me. And that's the attitude that most of the people in my home group have, and I am so grateful that no matter where you came from, no matter what's going on, we welcome everybody, you know, and I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so I said I really coasted on all the steps until I finally really think I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable by me. So I did make an 8th step and started to make amends. I made amends to that girl that I stopped talking to for all those years. I made amends to my immediate family, my mom, my dad, and my sister. And I think making that 8th step and seeing my how the damage that I caused these people is, it was another great way to see how unmanageable my life was. Because when you can't stop drinking, your life is unmanageable. You know, it's not like can't pay the bills. It's like you can't stop drinking, you know. And I just could not stop drinking to be a daughter, to be a sister. You know, I just told my sister I hated her. Because that's just what was best for me at the time, to get my emotions out. And I had to, I am so, so grateful that I've made those amends, because, I'll tell you, I remember, one time being in a meeting. For some reason, the meeting was changed from a room like this to, it was in the chapel part of the church. And, so we were sitting in the chapel, and, I had a grandfather who we were pretty close with my whole life, but I never really called him, especially since I moved down here. He was up in New Jersey, and he was a minister who retired, but he was a minister. And being in that chapel, and something that somebody shared in a meeting about making amends to somebody, and who later they died, and I knew he was getting old. He had some health issues. And just being in that chapel, all these things came to me, and I realized that I had no relationship with my grandparents. And I mean, it's like, I think you realize things when you're ready to realize them in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized that I needed to make amends to my grandparents for not being a part of their lives for so long. And I mean, it was like the floodgates opened, and I was a mess that night. But I was so grateful for realizing that, because I did start to, I made amends to my grandparents, and I called them regularly, and I was religious about calling them regularly. And I remember, the last time I talked with him, you know, and when he died, probably 9 months later or a year later, it was like, I got it, you know. I felt so grateful that I had done these amends already, and that I actually had a relationship with him when he died, and that not only that, but I could be there for my mom, who just lost her dad, you know. And that was the first time I really got to show up for my family in AA, and I really feel like it was the first kind of spiritual experience that I had, because we were sitting in my grandma's living room, you know, and my uncle had the idea to make a collage of pictures for his funeral to set up near the casket. And that's what we did all day. We just made this collage, and we made pictures, and I felt like I was exactly where I needed to be, and my side of the street was totally clean, and I was helping out in a way that, you know, it was just, I so loved doing that for my family, and it just really meant a lot to me. And and I remember, you know, that was also the first time that, although I was so grateful for what AA had given me, I remember coming back home to, you know, my home group and my friends, and feeling like, you know, there's nothing in the big book that talks about this. I feel like it was such a spiritual experience. I was like, I just want to go back there. You know, I feel like AA is not giving me a solution. I feel so much pain, but I feel so grateful at what's going on. And that was the first time I kind of had this bout with, like, AA doesn't have a solution for me. Like, I need to be with my family. And the more my sponsor directed me towards action in my home group and just prayer, you know, I kind of, like, felt like I came back down to earth, you know, off of my high pink cloud. But I was so grateful for that experience. And I've had other experiences like that with amends, too. I made amends to my dad. And my dad is someone, I am exactly like my dad. I can't even tell you. I mean, we are like two peas in a pod. I am my father's daughter for sure. We're the only two alcoholics in my immediate family. He was a functional alcoholic. And he, actually, when I was probably 2 years sober, he called me and asked me for help to get sober himself. And, I mean, I was at first I was so grateful for that because, you know, he had almost just died, I think, the night before, and he got honest with me about his drinking. And I talked to a lot of people in my home group who had parents that were alcoholics. Even with them in their home group, we have some, like, parent-son-daughter combos. And I talked to a lot of people, everyone I knew with experience, to see how they handled that. And what I learned is that this is just my experience, but me and my ego can take, you know, when someone says that you need to be a sober example of Alcoholics Anonymous, I take that to mean be their sponsor. And so that, I caused some more damage there in sobriety. And you know what? It's okay, because that's just how I learn what to do and what not to do here. But I would get frustrated that he didn't have a sponsor yet. And I would get frustrated that he, was making fun of the meetings with me. You know, and I would say, well, you should sit in the front row. You could listen better. Oh, don't go to that meeting anymore. That sounds like a bad meeting. And I'm like, well, what does your sponsor say about that, you know? And I got so resentful at him, you know, as a result of that. And I actually think I stopped talking to him for a little while because I just couldn't. Every time he called me, I was so angry at him. I wanted him to get this thing so bad and that we could be, you know, the father-daughter couples I see in my home group, you know, like, oh, look, this is my dad, you know. I've got a year, 2 years more than him, and, you know, make jokes at each other at the podium and talk about each other at the podium. And I wanted that so bad that but what I was doing didn't involve God at all. It was like I just wanted what was best for me, what I thought was best for me. I wanted him to get sober. I wanted him to have my kind of sobriety, and I wanted to tell him how to do it. And he wasn't really interested in that. And he slowly kind of stopped going. He didn't understand why you have to go to meetings every day. And once you lose the obsession to drink, which I think was lifted for him, he didn't understand, what's the point of a sponsor? I'm not going to take a drink today. I'm okay. Through all that, I stayed sober, thank God, and I prayed for him every night, and I still do pray for him every night, in fact. But I learned that I caused a lot of damage there. I learned to accept him for who he was, my dad. Not an alcoholic trying to get sober. He's my dad, and I've got to love him no matter what. And so, you know, I was able to just let him be. And he stopped going to Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't need to. And he's still dry, I think. But that was something I also had to make amends for. You know, it wasn't that, in addition to really not being there for him when he needed me when I was back in high school. And that was, like, one of the other most powerful amends I feel like I've gone through in my sobriety, because we both just think alike, you know, and he knew it meant so much. I know it meant so much to him that I would say that, and he knew, he was so proud of me for what I'd done, that I stopped drinking, and then I was like, had this little life I was building on my own, and I finally, he didn't have to talk to me about what's your path, what are you doing. He was just so proud of me, and we both cried that night. I mean, it was the most touching amends that I remember doing face to face, and I am very grateful that I did those amends too, because my dad's had, he's been dry for a little while now, and he, has, you know, gotten a fight with my mom, and he's kind of written me out of his life. Had nothing to do with me, but we haven't spoken in over 6 weeks now, and it is really, it's really painful for me, and I want so bad, I want to fix it, I want to go knock on his door and be like, I'm here, you've got to talk to me now, you know, and I want to, you know, bring my sister and my mom with me and be like, we're going to make amends, you know, like, what's going on? That's what I want to do. And instead, you know, my sponsor tells me to do things like, why don't you take an inventory? Take an inventory. I don't want to take an inventory. I want my dad back, you know? And she's like, you need to pray for him. Pray the, on page 66 and 67 about resentment. I'm like, I don't want to pray for him. I want him back, you know? But against my will, I take those actions. And day by day, I try to think of him more now as a sick alcoholic, because if he's a sick alcoholic, I can relate to that, because I've stopped talking to him too, actually on several occasions. God is my father. And it says, and I love this here, what it says in the third step, about selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. And it'll kill us if we don't address it. And God is the only thing that we can use to address our self-centeredness. And it says on page 62, it says, next we decided that hereafter, in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arc through which we passed to freedom. And I heard a speaker say recently, like, if God is the father, if there was a perfect father, you know, he would want everything for his children, the best of everything for his children. And they may not get everything that they want, but they get everything that they need, and he would never steer them wrong. And so I've decided to make God my new father, and that I have to take action and turn my whole life over to him. And I'm not saying I do it perfectly, because I definitely don't. But if I don't, I feel like I've got to fix everything, and I feel like the world is on my shoulders, and it's such a heavy burden. And then my head gets back to that black and white thinking, and that debate starts getting louder and louder, and I get more miserable. And when my sponsor tells me to do something like write an inventory, I feel like, wait, maybe you don't have all the facts. Hold on. Let's back up. Wait, let me explain to you how grand a problem this is, and then you'll understand that an inventory won't fix it. But the funny thing is, when I write an inventory, as painful as it might be, I feel better. You know, I feel like I've turned a giant elephant into, like, a little ant. Like, I can see it. I know where it's going. I'll bring it to my sponsor. And in regard to the third step, I mean, really, I am definitely not perfect at the third step. I'm perfect at selfishness and self-centeredness. But I try to be really open and honest with my sponsor, and that is so hard sometimes, especially when I have a way like I do right now with my dad. It saved my life. I can't even tell you how many times it saved my life. And my sponsor is now trying to tell me to be prompt and thorough with her. Like, I'm starting to write letters to my dad. She explained to me, you know, what kind of a letter I should write, and that it should just be all about what's going on with me in a couple sentences, not so much him. She's like, when I say that, I mean, you should write that tomorrow. Because my head is like, I'll write that next week. Maybe if I have time next Friday, maybe I'll write that after work, or maybe the Friday after that. But she clearly was like, that means tomorrow, you know, because any direction I get from her sometimes, I am so lazy, I think, like, okay, I'll get to that next weekend, you know. But it's important for me, personally, to be prompt, because I'm so lazy and slothful, it's crazy. But I try to be thorough with a sponsor, and to know that, you know, if I stop trying to be God, if I stop trying to run the show, life is really an easier and softer way if I hand it over to him. And like I said, I don't do it perfectly, but these promises in the third step I've been reading a lot too, and I want to point them out. It says, as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. And to me, those sound so amazing. I can't even begin to describe how much I want those for myself. And I've had glimpses of those in my sobriety before. But, you know, when things are good, you know. And when things are bad, it's like the world is going to end. You know, my dad just recently won a bout with cancer, and I just recently got engaged, and so I have a way. You know, I wanted to talk to my dad, and I am so afraid of tomorrow. I'm so afraid of what's going to happen. I want to know when he's going to come back. I want to know this. I want to know that. But, you know, my sponsor keeps saying to me, like, I have faith this will work out, but it's in God's time, you know. I don't pray for my dad to come back. I pray for God's will, and I pray that that he give me the strength to walk through this. And that's a kind of, that's another lesson I've had to learn in sobriety, that God isn't always going to give me what I want. You know, God will be with me in the times that I need him. And I think he's always with me. That's my personal belief. But he's just going to give me the strength to walk through the difficult things in sobriety so that I don't have to drink. To give me the courage to take these actions that I so don't want to take. Because if I don't take them, I will fail to grow and enlarge my spiritual life, and I will drink again. And when I'm drinking, I'm not of use to anybody. I'm not, I'm totally, the world is revolving around Emily again, and I'm miserable, you know. Maybe not while I'm drunk, but you've got to get sober up sometime every day. And I so don't want to return to that way of life. And then, moving on, I don't want to skip over the other steps, but I spoke a little bit about taking an inventory and how important that's been in my inventory, in my sobriety. I'm definitely not good at it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out is the 11th step. And I have found that to be an important step this past year with everything that's gone on in my life, good things and bad things. I guess I've found my own method of seeking, and I think that God is in the seeking, and I don't have a regimented meditation, but my prayer has become much more important to me, like my life depends on it. And it says in the 12 and 12 that, you know, we would no longer go without prayer and meditation as we would, you know, sunlight and water. And I don't know that I could say that every day is true, but when I'm really struggling, that's definitely true for me. And I'm so grateful for that step, because if I were running the show, like I said, that burden gets on my shoulders, and I've got to carry it around all day, and I'm not a pleasant person to be around. But when I can really pray, like, I need God in my life, like, I really need God, and I really mean it, and I'm really sincere about it, I feel like I don't have to do anything. I just have to do the work. You know, I heard a sponsor or a speaker say recently that, you know, God can move mountains, but you've got to bring a shovel. So I can do the praying, and I can ask God to for his will and to give me strength, but I've got to go and take these actions that are lined out in the big book. And my sponsor frequently refers to the big book as an instruction manual, and so I treat it as so. And then 12 step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I struggle with this step. I am a self-centered alcoholic. But recently I have gone to meetings with trying to make it a point that the newcomer is my purpose at meetings. It's my primary purpose for being in AA. And throughout the day, whenever I can get my phone out and call somebody, I'm not thinking about myself, and I do feel much better. And I've sponsored women in the past, and it has been such a joy. And none of them stuck around, but I'm sober, you know, and I don't know, just me and my selfishness, I don't know how long I could take it without being able and having the opportunity to reach out to other alcoholics and to work with them through the steps, or just to talk to them, or my sponsor even says just a smile to them at meetings, you know, just acknowledge they're there and that they're welcome, because someone did that for me and it saved my life. And carrying this message, or practicing these principles in all our affairs, I feel like I have come a long way with that. I know when I was newer, I really kind of led a double life. You know, I would come to meetings and be, you know, the happy greeter at the door, or, you know, with my like two batches of cookies. I would show up in AA, and then I would go to work, and I would just like hide under the table and hope nobody would see me not working, you know. Or I would get in fights with my dad or with my mom, or you know, just be thinking about me all the time, you know, what I can get, how I can manipulate people, living the same way I was drinking sober. And practicing these principles in all our affairs, that seems like a lot to ask of me. All these principles, like, which one can I pick today? You know, like, I mean, really? I don't successfully practice these principles in all my affairs. I do the best with what I've got, I think, and I'm learning. I feel like I'm still very new at this. And I just wanna get right sized every morning, you know, and I get on my knees and I pray that God help me do the best that I can today. And recently I feel like just showing up is sometimes the best I can do. Just showing up at AA. I go to meetings regularly. Actually, I heard this, not just because I'm alcoholic. I heard this, someone say this analogy one time, but they said, you know, if somebody gets shot, you know, they go to the hospital, they remove the bullet, and then their gunshot victim, who's recovered from their gunshot. But that doesn't mean that they're bulletproof. And I thought that was really funny, because that is kind of why I go to meetings. It's because I don't want to drink again. And I know, especially from recently, knowing how self-will I can, my head gets, I know that if I really let that run long enough, you know, and really just kind of gave up on God and then on my sponsor and on AA, and I would probably cut people out of my life and stop working the steps backwards until really I thought I can really control and enjoy my drinking, and I would go and I would leave here. It would probably take a little while because I am very surrounded with my home group and my sponsor and sober friends, but I know it to my core that that could happen to me. It will. It definitely will if I stop practicing these principles in all my affairs. So I'm very honored to speak here, Billy. Thank you so much for asking me. I guess that's it. I'm a little early, but thanks again for asking me, and thanks for letting me speak.